Good evening. I think I want to second what Rice said, that you are in a unique position here, and we all want to thank you for the work you're doing with the World Trade Organization meeting coming up. And also want to especially thank the students. The student movement today in the United States against sweatshops, United Students Against Sweatshops, in my opinion, it's the strongest human rights and labor rights movement alive in the country today. And it's growing by leaps and bounds, so we have a chance to speak about it towards the end. Right now, there's about 150 chapters of United Students Against Sweatshops across the country, and campuses are pouring in every single week. I'm going to just talk about the global economy and do it by trying to put a human face on it, human face behind the labels. And I'll just tell a bunch of stories until you've had enough and you scream and run out of the room, and then we'll know the meeting's over. Last week, I spent the week with two women from El Salvador who worked in a maquila company, and they had been fired because they tried to meet to learn their rights. They worked in a place called Caribbean Apparel. This was Blanca Palacios and Lorena Carmen. They worked in Caribbean Apparel in El Salvador, where they sold clothing for Kathy Lee Gifford's Walmart label and also for Kmart and Leslie Fay. Like I said, they were fired because they dared to meet to learn their rights and to defend themselves and end the maltreatments in the factory. I also was with a young man about 25 years old who was a union organizer, Giovanni Fuentes. And because he worked with the women in this factory, because he advised them on their legal rights, he received two death threats. He was called in by the company attorney, and he was told, Giovanni, you and your friends should leave the work if you want to live. We suggest you leave the work. Giovanni, you understand that when you're dealing with the maquila in El Salvador, you're dealing with the mafia. And Giovanni, you have to understand that in El Salvador, you can have someone killed for 100 colones. That's about $12.50. That's why we took these workers immediately to the United States, to throw some protection over them, some public visibility. And it worked. And one of the reasons it worked was because of the students. We did a couple of press conferences. I was told there were 550 press hits, or radio stations, newspapers, or TV, enough to cover them, enough to protect them, to help protect them and defend their rights. They went back to El Salvador on Tuesday of last week, and we're monitoring the situation as closely as we can. Caribbean Apparel is typical of sweatshops throughout Latin America or Asia. It's located in a place called the American Free Trade Zone in Santa Ana. It's about an hour and a half from San Salvador. It's surrounded by the cinder block walls, by the barbed wire, by the locked metal gates, by the armed guards. Inside the factory, young women are locked for 12 hours a day, essentially 11-hour shifts, 6 days a week, from 6:50 in the morning till about 6:10 at night, or 6:40, and sometimes they work until 9:40. Of course, all the overtime work is forced. If they don't stay for the overtime, they're fired. The factory is about 100 degrees. There's no proper ventilation. It's a true sweatshop in that sense. The women are paid 60 cents an hour, which meets one-third of the cost of living. It's not even close to a subsistence wage. They made these Kathy Lee pants, and for every $16.96 pair of pants they made, they got paid 15 cents. These pants here. Supervisors went up and down the aisles. It's all done by piecework. They're all in the production lines. And they would smash the tables of the sewing machine and tell them to go faster. You know, stop your mind from wandering. Get down to work. You're not here for a vacation. They're not allowed to talk to each other. Typical in the factories, they could use the bathroom twice a day, once in the morning and once in the afternoon, and they need permission in order to use the bathroom. This place, like the other factories, they wouldn't give the workers clean water to drink. They drink filthy tap water. Women refer to it as urine. It's warm, it's yellow, it makes them sick to their stomach. In order to get a job, you had to take pregnancy tests. And if you tested positive, you were fired, you had to pay for those pregnancy tests. But the big issue was just fear. I mean, there was sexual harassment. If the supervisor liked one of the younger women and you didn't express interest in him, you'd be fired. They would scream at the workers. If they thought a worker was getting a little too uppity, they'd lock the young woman in a room in isolation for several hours. There were even incidences where the supervisors would jab the women with the scissors that, you know, they were cutting the threads off their clothing with. You know, just teach them a lesson. And there were even accounts of women being hit in the factory. But the biggest issue underlying the factory for the workers was the fear. The constant reminder that you'll be fired if you try to meet to learn your rights. That you'll be fired if you even carry around the country's labor code. Because if you have the labor laws of the country, you're a troublemaker. And you better get rid of that troublemaker before the disease spreads. You'll be fired if they even see you meeting and grouping together. Even if they don't know what you're meeting about, you'll fire three or four people just to send a message. You better not be meeting about something serious. You better not be meeting about your rights. And of course, if you try to organize, you won't be fired, you'll be blacklisted immediately. And those are the conditions at Caribbean Apparel. I'm going to come back to it, but of course, Kathy Lee got upset again and went on her television program and went on the attack. And we had a little run-in with her husband, Frank Gifford. And at the end of it, they were saying that Kathy Lee was the Joan of Arc of sweatshops. And the Washington Post commented, well, she must be hearing some very strange voices. And so we'll come back to it. I think they made a lot of mistakes, but they tried to crash our press conferences, and I think it blew up in their face. Well, I'm going to stick with El Salvador for a second. We were meeting with women at a factory called Dual, which in El Salvador, it's another one of the maquilas, which produces garments for export to the United States. And the women have told us over the years that they're forced to work, same thing, 6:45 in the morning until 7 o'clock at night, a 12-hour shift. However, three or four nights a week, they work until 10:30. So they're working a 15-and-a-half-hour shift. And right now, during the busy season, they work on Saturday until 6, and on Sunday they work until 5 o'clock. So they're working 7 days a week. And it's the same process. To get a job in these factories, you have to undergo these pregnancy tests. And if you test positive, you're fired. You come into the factory, and it's that same pressure to produce, 115 to 150 pieces an hour. The same screaming, the locked bathrooms, the no water. They tell us the factory is like vapor. It's like steam. Women are actually fainting during the workday. And the same fear that every time the workers try to meet to assert their rights, they're fired. This factory, this Dual factory, makes these Liz Claiborne garments. So, for example, at the Dual factory, they made this $198 Liz Claiborne jacket. The women were paid 74 cents to make it. So the wages that the women were paid come to only 0.4% of the retail price of the garment. We sent students down from Columbia University, graduate students, to meet with the women that worked in this Dual factory to do a living wage study. Well, the wage is adequate to survive on. Of course, they found out that the wages came to only about 1/3 of the real cost of living at a subsistence level. These are truly starvation wages, arbitrarily set, and we're going to release this report in about 2 weeks. But just because women from the Dual factory met with the students from Columbia University, they were fired. I think that's one of the reports we left outside. They were called in one by one, five women, and they said, the management said to them, you're fired for crying to the gringos, and we don't want a union here, just for meeting with U.S. students. And, of course, they've tried to organize a union at this particular factory five times, and each time it's been crushed with illegal firings and blacklistings. Not far from that factory, there was a place called Formosa Textiles. And we found out about this factory because a woman who had been working there had been beaten and fired. And she went into a human rights office, Codafarm in El Salvador, and she wanted to file a complaint. She wanted help. And she explained that she had been attacked at work, and they asked her what her crime was, what she did. She said, well, I took a day off from work because I'm a single mother, and I had a three-year-old daughter, and she was sick, and I had no money to put her to daycare. It cost about $1.63 a day for daycare. I didn't have a single cent, and I had to stay with her. When she went to work the next day, she was attacked by her supervisor, who was a man much larger than her, and she described it that he grabbed her by the shoulders, and he took his knee, and he kneed her in the thigh very hard so that her whole thigh was black and blue. He tried to slap her a few times. As she ran away to escape, he tried to lunge out and kick her and knock her over. She ran away crying, and they fired her. And they said to her, well, what label do you make? And she made Nike shirts in El Salvador. So we can talk about Nike justice. By the way, the women were paid 20 cents to make this $75 Nike shirt. So this reaches almost new levels of exploitation. Maybe Disney's the only other company that comes close. Because now the wages are down to 0.3% of the retail price of the garment. And the women walked us through their day. Exact same. I mean, I'm repeating myself. But to get a job in the factory, mandatory pregnancy test. They charge their workers 90 colones. That's 2 days' pay. To take the test, and if they test positive, they're fired. The same forced overtime. 12-hour shift. And they help the workers stay. The Nike contract that helps the workers because at the end of the 8-hour shift, when you'd be going home, say at 5:40, they keep them until 7 or later. They take the time cards away from them so that if they were to leave without staying for the overtime, they wouldn't be paid for the entire day. They'd lose the whole day's wages. Besides, if they didn't stay for the overtime, they'd be suspended without pay and then eventually fired. So you got the same forced overtime, the same pregnancy test, the same heat, lack of ventilation. And the women told us that they were searched on the way into the factory to take candy away from them. This is also typical. But Nike, you see, doesn't want the workers bringing in Tootsie Rolls. God forbid they should get a little chocolate stain on their garment. So on the Nike justice, you're searched. They take candy and water away from you. The women are not allowed to talk to each other because they need to keep the production going. In this particular factory, called Formosa Textiles, they brought in the supervisors. It's a Korean-owned factory in El Salvador. They brought the supervisors from Bangladesh because they figured the men would be a lot tougher on the women. And indeed they were. And they would be yelling at them to go faster. For that reason, they were not allowed to use the bathroom. The same system. You raise your hand, you get a ticket, you present it to the guard at the toilet. You can use the bathroom once in the morning and once in the afternoon. You could drink water once in this factory. Same thing. Get the ticket, give it to the guard at the sink, and you could drink the filthy tap water. That makes the woman sick. In this factory, you couldn't wear any makeup, which struck us, you know, we hadn't heard that one before. Like, why can't you wear makeup? And, of course, it was because the factory was 100 degrees, and Nike was afraid that the women would sweat and wipe the perspiration from their faces with the Nike garment, and if they were wearing lipstick or other makeup, it would, again, soil the garment. Nike would lose a few pennies. So that's a serious offense. They patrol the aisles looking for lipstick. And if you got it, you're out of there, and you're fined, and you lose the day's pay. The same firings, the same fear. Anyone who stood up to defend their rights or even question their rights was fired. And I said to the women in the factory, like, what about the Nike code of conduct? You know, they say they got this code of conduct that defends the rights of workers everywhere in the world. And the workers said, sure, they have a code of conduct. They make us wash our hands in the morning. That's the part of it they impose because they don't want us getting the garments dirty. And when we do white Nike garments, they give us plastic gloves to wear. So that was their code of conduct. That was the Nike code of conduct, the Nike justice. Now, I don't know if you can see these, but this is the factory that made the Liz Claiborne garments. It's exactly like the factory that made the Nike garments. It could be, it's in El Salvador, but it could be anywhere in Central America or anywhere in Asia. It's always the same. The cinder block wall or a concrete wall 15 foot high, topped with the razor wire, the locked metal gate, and the young women lining up to go into work. If any students here, if you came up afterwards and looked at this, these people are younger than you are. But they're not in a great university. They're not getting an education. They're going into factories where they're locked for 12 hours a day. You can see they're very young. And on the ground, there's pieces of plastic because there's no place for them to eat. So when they go out during lunch hour, they either sit in the mud or the dirt. And to protect themselves, they bring a piece of plastic, which is why the plastic's laying around. When the door opens, the young women go through, and behind the door there's always an armed thug. He jumped out of the way when he saw my camera. And, you know, it's not like they carry little sticks or batons. They carry sawed-off shotguns and big rifles. All of these factories are in exactly the same position. In El Salvador, 80% of the workers, at least, are women. 50% of them are single mothers, young women. They go into these factories where they're locked behind the metal gates, the thugs, the barbed wire. I'm going to tell you a short story about trying to research these places and what it's like for the women. We were out in front of this Duol factory, and we always try new techniques, because everything you do has to be done in a clandestine manner. You could never walk up in front of these factories to do interviews. I've been in front of these factories when the armed thugs have kept out members of the labor ministry. And they just laugh at the people from the government. They say, oh, the boss isn't here you want to see. Come back tomorrow. And of course, if you went back tomorrow, the boss isn't there either. No one goes in and out of these factories that the thugs don't want to go in there. If any of the students here worked in a factory there, and if their parents wanted to get them a message, or there was an emergency, or medicine, or some message, they'd be shot before they could get into these factories. Well, we were using a van with polarized windows. We figured we could do some of our interviews like that. We'd take the van, we'd park it about maybe 100 yards away from the factory, and we'd have fired workers who we were working with would go out of the van back to the workers during lunchtime, and she'd say, there's some labor rights people from the United States. They're interested in your case. Perhaps they can help. And the women would come around to the van. We'd throw open the door. They'd jump in the van. We'd smash the door, close it shut, and no one could see us. You couldn't see into this van. And we did a lot of interviews like that. Someone saw us from the factory, and we're sitting in the van doing an interview, and all of a sudden a pickup truck comes up behind us, and the doors open on both sides, and two guys get out with shotguns, and they make a big sweep coming towards our van like that. And we decided, on a spur of the moment, just pull out as fast as we could possibly go. And obviously we did. And we left. As we made the turn, there was a bus stop, and we left the women off at the bus stop so that they could innocently pretend they were waiting for a bus. We kept going. This truck followed us for about 15 minutes, it felt like that. It felt endless. So it's not possible to just waltz up to these places and research. A little while ago, I'm losing track of time, but it was this summer, we were in El Salvador with students from five different universities on a delegation. We're making a video about the student movement. And we wanted to make a video through the students' eyes, what it was like when they met with workers their own ages. What was like when they saw the factories? What was it like when we went into the neighborhoods and saw how people lived? What was it like to talk to people who had been beaten up by their managers and fired? Well, we went to a Nike factory, the factory that makes this, Formosa Textiles and Evergreen. And, of course, we were turned away by the armed guards. We were not allowed entry, even though we told a few white lies. The students said that they were interns, student interns with Nike, but they didn't fall for it. And the manager came out and said, Nike determines who comes in and out of this factory, period. And they didn't alert us to your visit, so you're not coming in. But you could see the workers with little Nike vests on, little swishes, with the armed guards, and they were working behind the fence. We left there. We went to a place called Santa Ana, where the Caribbean Apparel factory was also located. And through the research, we knew there was a factory called Exmotica, which also made Nike's clothing, but children's clothing. We went to the factory. We got there just at lunchtime, and the gate was open because the workers were coming in and out for lunch. There was an armed guard right next to the door. I had some Nike clothing I'd purchased in New York because we're doing research on the pricing of the garments. So I said to the students, let's go. The door's open. We walked right up. The armed guard figured we must be North American buyers or whatever. We said good afternoon to him, and we walked right past the guy with the gun, and we went into the factory. And we're walking around the factory, and yes, it was confirmed. They were making Nike's children's clothing. They were doing Adidas. They were doing Lee. And, you know, I get nervous when I do this. We're in the factory. I knew we were going to get, you know, captured eventually. And we're taking pictures, and we're doing a videotape, and I'm doing an interview standing up inside the factory. And I found labels that said, made in the USA. Now, either they were doing transshipments, illegal transshipments, or maybe there were samples. But anyway, we're eventually surrounded, you know, maybe it took about 5 minutes. We're eventually surrounded by the management. And I expected them to say, you know, throw us out and yell and scream a little bit. And they're asking me, what are you doing in here? And I said the door was open, which it was. And we're in here and they're screaming. But then they turned very violent and they attacked the students, especially the women. And they saw the cameras and they went ballistic. And so they're grabbing the students and they're trying to pull them down. At the same time, they're trying to drag the cameras off their necks. And at first the students were resisting. And, you know, eventually I was watching this thing and it was getting kind of rough and almost out of control. So I said to everybody, give up the film. They broke one of the cameras. They took the film. And I see the manager and he's standing there and he's going like this. He's screaming at the top of his lungs. He's going like this. Of course, he's calling over the shotguns, which they did come. Then we were surrounded by the people with the shotguns. So this is North American students in a factory and we're being attacked, and we're surrounded by these thugs and these goons. Well, they did take the camera, but I was hooked up with a microphone, so which they didn't discover. So at least we got out with the sounds of these people screaming at us, yelling and telling us in El Salvador we'd do anything we damn well please. And in fact, the factory Ex Modica is owned by the sister of the former president of El Salvador, Calderon Sol, who's really the power behind the recently elected President Flores. And when we came out of the factory, we knew we only had a little bit of time to get away from that because they would call the police. So we left there and we went to a square in Santa Ana and we interviewed the students immediately, right after this incident in the factory. And it turned out to be really very moving because the students had tasted a tiny bit of the repression that these workers face every single day. If they're doing that to students from Yale and from University of Kentucky and Middlebury and Vermont, if they're doing this to the students, the message came through loud and clear. The women in that factory have no rights. If they ever stood up for higher wages or more respect or dignity, they would be handled very, very, very toughly. Salvadorans we were with told us, labor people, human rights people, that if they had gone into the factory with us, they'd probably be hanging up somewhere getting electric shock treatment, you know. We were laughing about it afterwards because we were so nervous. But those interviews are going into the tape we're doing now. We hope it, Nike's happy about it. The tape left that factory, the Nike factory. They stole a tape out of one of the video cameras, and they sent it to a factory that produces for Walmart, which was why the death threats came about, because they saw our discussions on this tape, why that Giovanni was threatened with death. Well, you know, in El Salvador right now, there's 225 factories, used as an example, 225 maquila factories, 70,000 young women working in those factories. They produce 581 million garments a year for export to the United States. It's up now. It's 50 million garments a month. El Salvador, tiny El Salvador, is the seventh largest exporter of apparel to the United States worldwide. Imports of apparel have grown from 198 million in 1992 to 1.2 billion last year, a 600% increase. Everything's booming except worker rights. There's not one single union in any of the maquila in El Salvador because it's not allowed. Despite the pregnancy test, the starvation wages, the beatings, the humiliation, people being stripped of their rights, despite all of that, the heat, the lack of water, the locked bathrooms, there's not one single union because every time the workers try to defend themselves, they're fired and blacklisted. Not one. The maquila is booming. Now there's talk in El Salvador of lowering the wages from 60 cents an hour to 36 cents an hour. They say it's too high. The 60 cents. This is the World Trade Organization. They're saying it's too high. It's too high. We better lower it in the countryside to 36 cents an hour. Well, you know, if Nike had the chance to come in here, that would be nice if they did. If Nike came in here, they'd say to you, you're a decent people here. Sunday night, what are you doing here? You should be home watching television or something. But don't be naive. 60 cents is a good wage. You're not living in Seattle or New York City. You're in El Salvador, you can live on 60 cents. It's a good wage. These are good jobs. And when you ask the women about that, they look you right in the face and they say it's a lie because you cannot live on the 60-cent wages. And they run us through their day real quickly that just to get back and forth to work costs 68 cents. A tiny breakfast at the job, since they're getting up so early. You know, when you think of it, when they're working these 6:45 in the morning shifts, 6:45 until 7 o'clock at night or 10:30, workers are getting up at 5 o'clock in the morning and getting home at 7:30 or 11:30 with no chance at all to spend with their children. I mean, it's completely, what strikes you is the exhaustion of the people, the bags under their eyes, the lack of sleep, the lack of any decent food, the constant pressure and screaming at the workers. Well, anyway, they spend 80 cents for a small breakfast, rice, beans, you know, maybe a little roll, a cup of coffee. For lunch, it costs them $1.49, the exact same thing. Rice, beans, maybe a scrap of chicken, tortilla, and a lemonade, fake lemonade they call it, because they can't afford soda, it's too expensive. Well, that's $2.97. The wages are 60 cents an hour, actually a little bit less. So the daily pay is 42 colones, which is $4.79. So your daily pay is $4.79, you take out $2.97, just for the round trip bus and for breakfast and lunch, and you're left with $1.82. Well, you have to live somewhere. So for a one-room hovel in El Salvador that a whole family will share, one room, without indoor plumbing, use an outhouse, and there'll be one sink that several families will share. That's $31.40 a month. That's $1.03 a day. Well, you take the $1.03 from the $1.82 and you're left with 79 cents. But what do you do now? The cheapest supper you could have is about $1.14 for the exact same thing. A family of three, 38 cents apiece. Each person would be allotted 38 cents to each supper. Rice, beans, maybe they'd split one plantain for a family of three, and coffee. Well, they can't even afford that because they're only left with 79 cents. Women in El Salvador are raising their children on coffee because they can't afford milk. Something is completely crazy and viciously wrong when women could be making $75 Nike shirts and yet they're raising their children on coffee. Or they're making the Liz Claiborne jackets, $198 jackets, and they're raising their children on coffee. They tell us maybe the two paydays, they're paid every 14, 15 days. Maybe on those two paydays they buy a little bit of milk. But they can't afford any vitamins or they can't afford any vegetables or cereal or juice for their kids. Nothing. And you ask them what they would do if they had a little bit better a wage. And they say they'd buy milk, school books, clothing for their kids to go to school. It costs $8 for new shoes to send your kid to school. Like I said before, about $1.63 a day for daycare. None of this can they afford. The Nike shirts, it's a special shirt. It says that it takes the sweat off your body and throws it into the air so you stay dry. And when we read this to the women, they all started laughing. They said, well, we need these things because it's 100 degrees in the factory. We ought to be wearing them. And, what would happen if Nike paid a subsistence wage to the workers? The workers have told us that if they could have their wages increased from 60 cents to about $1.18 an hour, they could climb out of misery and into poverty. Now, would the whole sky fall in on Nike if they paid a subsistence wage? If Nike paid them $1.18 an hour, there would be 39.5 cents of labor in the shirt, which is less than 0.5% of the retail price of the shirt. At 60 cents an hour, there's 20 cents of labor. At $1.18 an hour, there would be 39.5 cents. In other words, there's enormous greed driving this whole thing. Enormous greed. And the students should never pull back from the issue of a living wage. It's very possible. And if you keep going, you're going to win this thing. The Liz Claiborne jacket, 74 cents of labor in it. If Liz Claiborne paid the workers a sustainable wage, there'd be about $1.44 or $1.45 of labor in this jacket, less than 0.9% of the retail price of the garment. They could easily afford to do it. The other day, probably 2 months, Nike put out a press release. They're very sophisticated. They spend $650 million a year in advertising. They put out a press release and they said, we are raising the wages of our workers in Indonesia from 250,000 rupiah to 265,000 rupiah. And a 6% wage increase. And the media applauded and actually recognized the great social conscience of Nike. And I smelt a rat. I figured something's going on here. So I went and I looked up the value of the rupiah to the dollar. And, of course, at that particular time, there were 10,080 rupiah to the dollar. So Nike gave a wage increase, all right, from 14 cents an hour to 15 cents an hour. They gave a 1 cent increase to their workers. Nike's got 70,000 workers in Indonesia. Nike makes 20 million pairs of sneakers a year in Vietnam, paying the workers 33 cents an hour. And in China, Nike uses one factory compound called Yuyan, where there are 50 to 60,000 workers in one factory complex. There are only 37,000 footwear workers left in the entire United States. There's more workers in one factory making sneakers for Nike in China than there is in the entire United States. I was in China this summer, and we went to in northern China to a city called Jiaozhou, and there were 21,000 workers there making Nike sneakers. And Nike had swishers on the factories, and it said, just do it, right behind the barbed wire and the locked metal gates and the thugs. They're very proud of it. The workers were paid 23 cents an hour, and they were working 12-hour shifts. Just do it. Nike's very proud of itself. We went into a factory in China that made kid sneakers, and the women in the factory, very young, we'll come back to this, but all of the workers in China are 17 to 25 years of age. At 25 years of age, you're fired. Because of the 16-hour shifts, you're all used up anyway, and you may get pregnant, and they're not going to pay maternity benefits, so you're gone at 25. Well, in this factory, the women looked very young, 16 or even younger. And they were putting the glue on the kegs with their bare hands. Toxic glue was right next to them. XXX strong, which they couldn't read. But when you went through the factory, your eyes were stinging you. And the implement they had given the workers was a toothbrush. So they had the toxic glues and they were putting it on with the toothbrush in their hands. And there was no respirators, no nothing, no gloves, zero. No proper ventilation. And at the end of the day, the workers had to leave the factory in single file as an imposition of discipline on these workers. If you were the head of a production line, you were like production line one. Well, you stood up with your sign one, and all of the workers at the end of the day had to gather together behind you in single file, and you left the factory. Whole lines of workers like that, just to let them know who the boss is, and that discipline will be maintained. And it wasn't just sneakers and garments. Although there was a company called Deep E, which is a small progressive shoe company in Oregon. And they said they're a part of Corp America. And they said that we use hemp, natural hemp. But we make the shoes in China. And the workers get paid $3.15 an hour. This is what the boss said. Well, we found the factory.